Our study of the book of Revelation, last book in the Bible, started a number of months ago. Tonight we're not bringing it to a close, but we're certainly getting near the end of the book. Revelation chapter 20. We have seen in the past two chapters the downfall, the destruction of many of the enemies of God's people. The ones who were living in the first century who were being persecuted by the Roman Empire. And we saw that these enemies of God's people were symbolically represented by the two beasts, the land beast and the sea beast and the harlot. And they represented these, the enemies of God's people represented through the Roman Empire, the pagan Roman government, the concilia, the priest, if you will, of the emperor, who were trying to enforce emperor worship upon the Christians, trying to get them to bow down to the emperor. And so we see in the last two chapters, chapters 18 and 19, that those two beasts and the harlot were destroyed. They were killed. And they were gone. Only one enemy of God's people is seen to still be alive, and of course that's the dragon, the great red dragon, Satan. And it's his demise, his end, his destruction that is talked about in Revelation chapter 20. I think, as we've mentioned many times before, the only way to understand this book is by putting yourselves as best you can in the shoes of the people living in the first century and reading the letter as if it were written directly to you. Maybe you were living in Laodicea, or you were living in Thyatira or Pergamon, and you get this letter, you've experienced persecution yourself. You may have had friends or family members killed by this pagan Roman empire. Your friends or relatives refused to bow down to the emperor, and so they were persecuted, they were tormented, tortured, and maybe even killed. So you experienced that firsthand. You receive this letter from the apostle, and this apostle throughout the letter encourages you to remain faithful, to remain steadfast, that while the persecution will continue for a while, it's not going to continue forever. And that your enemies, as depicted by the beast and the harlot and the Satan and the dragon, will be defeated. And so throughout the book, there's the message of hope, there's the message of joy, there's the message of rejoicing, there's the message of, look what awaits you if you just remain faithful. This great persecution is not going to last forever. It's going to come to an end. And so that's the real background, that's the real context of the book. And so when we keep that in mind, we can understand much more of Revelation chapter 20. I mentioned this morning that these 10 verses that begin Revelation chapter 20 are probably the most misunderstood verses in the Bible. And maybe I should have prefaced that by saying, or added to it, the most misapplied verses in the Bible. Because some very false concepts, beliefs have come about from just these few verses. Entire belief and faith systems have been built around just these 10 verses without looking at anywhere else in the Bible. Everything is looked at in just 10 verses. And people's faith is built on just 10 verses. And we see how shaky a foundation that is, to base your beliefs on just a few verses in a book that is admittedly very symbolic and very figurative. Why do that? And so we're looking at Revelation chapter 20, and let's read the first three verses. John says, "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who's the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things he must be released for a little while." There's the picture John sees. He sees an angel coming down from heaven. And what does he have? He has a key. And it's to this bottomless pit. Some translations have the abyss. And what does he have? He has this great chain. And what's he going to do with it? He's going to bind Satan. Now, why, reading that, would you ever believe he's talking about anything literal or physical? John sees this vision, and he sees an angel with a key. Would it be a literal key? Why would anyone think it's a literal key? Well, most people that I've read from various faiths don't believe it's a literal key. Just like Peter and the apostles were given keys, Matthew chapter 16, what were those keys symbolic of? Peter and the apostles were given authority and power to open up the kingdom. And of course they did that on Pentecost in Acts chapter 2 when they preached that first gospel sermon, full gospel sermon, so that people were allowed entrance into the kingdom. Those were symbolic keys. This is a symbolic key as well. Angel has a key, but what's it to? This bottomless pit. Is there such a thing as a bottomless pit? No. So this is another symbol. Okay. The great red dragon, Satan, is going to be chained in this bottomless pit. So the angel has a chain, a literal physical chain. What good would that do against a spirit being? Satan is a spirit being, has no physical form. So would a physical chain be able to bind a spirit being? Of course not. So here we have a figurative key, a figurative abyss, a figurative chain. We have a spirit being, Satan, and now he's bound for 1,000 years. Now why, when you're reading all of that, would you assume that the 1,000 years is literal? Why would you assume that? Nothing else so far has been. But that's usually what's done. All of those things are assumed to be figurative. Then we get down to 1,000 years. We want to make that an exact, literal time period of exactly 1,000 years. It doesn't seem to fit the type of interpretation people usually do. But of course, that's what was done. And this is the basis right here of the entire premillennial, postmillennial, dispensationalism belief system. Right there. Based on a phrase, 1,000 years, that is buried in a context that is highly figurative and symbolic. But that 1,000 years is made to be entirely literal and nothing else in that section literal except the 1,000 years. You see what kind of, if you want to say, shaky foundation that is in trying to interpret God's Word. Taking one thing out of the entire part and making it to be a literal 1,000 years. Very seldom in the Bible is the term 1,000 used literally. And we could look at a number of passages. We don't have time. Let's just look at one. Psalm 50, verse 10. You'll recognize this when you read it, but let's read Psalm 50, verse 10, and we'll see what I'm talking about. The 50th Psalm and verse 10 of that. Psalm 50, verse 10. The writer says, "For every beast," this is talking about God, "for every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle on 1,000 hills. Would you take that literal? Does God own the beast and the cattle on 999 hills and in 1,000 hills, but he doesn't hold it on the 1,001st hill? You would never take that literal. And that's typically the way the term 1,000 is used throughout the Bible. So if we're going to use sound Bible interpretation, we need to use the term 1,000 like it's typically used in the Bible. What's he saying? God owns the cattle on how many hills? Well, they're all his, right? It's a full time. It's a complete time. And that's what it signifies. And that seems to be what it signifies in Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 3. A full amount of time, a complete amount of time. Known to us? Nope. known to God, absolutely, because he's the one that said it. So what happens during this? Satan is bound for 1,000 years. He's shut into this bottomless pit. He's shut up, and a seal is put on him so that he should deceive the nations no more. So what was the purpose of binding him with this great chain? So he wouldn't deceive the nations no more. When was he doing that? In the first and second and third century, that's when he was doing it. That's what we've been talking about since Revelation chapter 1. How Satan was behind pagan Rome. And how Satan was using pagan Rome to try and defeat God's people, defeat the church, destroy the church. And he was using so many different methods through this pagan government. So many different ways. It looked at times, as we'll see in a minute, like he was going to win. It did. It looked like he was going to win. So here we have God binding Satan. Does that mean Satan was not going to ever have any more influence? Well, of course not. Satan wasn't going to be destroyed when he was bound. You don't, when you bind something today, if you chain up a dog or chain up something, you don't entirely get rid of the dog, or the dog doesn't cease to live or anything. It's still there, has an influence, doesn't barks and can scare people. But it doesn't have that full influence it did before. And that seems to be the context here. If we're going to stick with just exactly what he's talking about and not go any further than that and make any conjectures, that's the context. That's what he's doing. And so for this time period, he is going to be bound. Certainly wasn't bound in the first century, was he? He had a tremendous influence in the first century. Satan did, through the pagan Roman Empire. And so Satan is, by God, bound, not with a physical chain, because that simply doesn't make any sense. He's not going to be bound with any type of physical anything. Well, how can Satan be bound anyway? You know, Satan doesn't have today, and he didn't in the 2nd century, 3rd century, 4th century, 5th century, Satan doesn't have any direct power over me, does he? Doesn't have any power over you. Bible says, resist him and he'll flee from you. Satan cannot directly do anything to me, but I can allow him to do something to me. And that's how he has power over me personally, is if I allow him to have power over me. And it says at the end of this 1,000 years, he's going to be released for a little while. A lot of different ideas about what that may or may not mean, but we'll look when we finish this chapter, because he talks about it more. So the 1,000 years. Well, let's look at what he's talking about in the next few verses and kind of bring it together. So what does John see? And I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the Word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. They lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. It says he saw what? The souls of who? Those who had been beheaded, those who had been martyred. For what? For their witness to Jesus. And there were countless numbers of those in the first and second century who were beheaded, who were killed, who were martyred, because they refused to bow down to any sort of god, to any sort of emperor, idol, or anything else. And because of their refusal to bow down, they were what? They were killed. Remember going all the way back several chapters? What did John see under the altar? The souls of those people who had been martyred. And they were doing what? They're crying out, "How long, O Lord, before you take vengeance on those people who did this to me?" In Revelation chapter 20, we saw in Revelation 18 and 19, God's vengeance on the beast and the harlot. And now we see God's vengeance on Satan in Revelation chapter 20. So these three chapters represent the fulfillment of that plea by those souls under the altar, "How long, O God?" And so we see God taking vengeance on those enemies. We saw how he took vengeance on the Roman Empire, how the Roman Empire was brought down. Brought down by outward enemies, brought down by natural disasters, brought down by that moral decadence that ate away at the Roman Empire from within. We saw how that brought down the empire. But who brought it down? The Bible says God did it. How did God do it? Through natural disasters, through moral decadence, through enemies of the Roman Empire. The Bible says God was behind all of that. We saw that in chapter after chapter after chapter. So God has brought His vengeance on His people's enemies, primarily that Roman Empire and the Roman emperors, for what they've done to His people. So now He sees some victory by His people. And this, of course, is that same 1,000 years. And they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead did not live again until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Now, whenever you have a first resurrection, you're expecting to have what? A second resurrection, of course, because that wouldn't make any sense calling it the first resurrection if there were no more resurrections ever. So this is the first resurrection. Now, if we think about how is this going to affect people living in the first century, that's how you have to answer every single question in the book of Revelation. How would it affect people living in the first century? Well, first of all, they're going to be rejoicing because their arch enemy Satan is what? Bound. So that's going to give them consolation. And even if Satan is loosed for a little season, it's a little season, right? 1,000 years represents a complete time period. So a little season would represent what? Small amount of time. And W.B. West, who taught at Harding Graduate School for a long time, wrote one of the best commentaries on Revelation ever, believed that the loosing of Satan for a little time was simply those few time periods, especially in the first few centuries, when there would be brief uprisings against God's people by various emperors until that Roman government was completely and totally brought down sometime in the 4th century. I think that has a lot of basis in God's Word. A lot of people in the Lord's church believes that right before Christ comes, that there is going to be a general lack of faith among God's people. That their influence and faith is going to decrease and decrease and decrease. And it's because of that that Satan will have such a huge influence on the world. In other words, it would be Christians' fault. And so when that happened, people would know it was about the end. The problem I have with that, but that to me would seem like it's a sign. And the Bible very specifically says there are no signs of Christ coming. No one knows when that's going to happen. There's not going to be any signs when that's going to happen. While that may be the truth about that answer to the Satan being loosed, I have a problem with it being a sign. Whatever it is, it couldn't possibly be a sign. So there's the first resurrection. So what all would it entail, the first resurrection? Well, if this 1,000 years is going to represent that time period when the Roman Empire now has been defeated, it's been destroyed, never to rise again, then that main enemy, the worst enemy that the church had ever seen, would be gone. And from that point on until near the end of time would represent that time period. And that certainly seems to fit the context. And we don't ever want to get away from the Bible and make up a lot of conjectures about what it might be and what it might not be. That would certainly fit the context, and that would certainly be very consoling and comforting to the people living in the first century. So what was resurrected? Well, think about what the Roman Empire was doing to the church. What was the Roman Empire trying to do? Kill it. Trying to kill the cause of Christ. It's trying to kill the church. That was the purpose of the Roman Empire. That's why they were trying to kill Christians every chance they got, was to destroy the church, to kill it. Well, when the Roman Empire was finally destroyed itself, what could happen? Well, there could be a great resurrection. Physically? No. Not a physical resurrection. But a spiritual one, absolutely. And I think that seems to fit the context very well. The fact that the cause of Christ was able to come out and prosper. It had prospered some during the persecution, but now it had a much greater chance of doing so. So what happens? He says, blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. So the first resurrection is what? It's a positive thing. That's what he says here. That blessed and holy. Every person has a part in that first resurrection. Blessed and holy. Because over such the second death has no power. But they shall be what? Priests of God and of Christ and shall reign with him 1,000 years. And there's 1,000 years brought up again. Why would we suppose that's any different 1,000 years than any of the other 1,000 years he's talked about? It all seems to be the same circumstance, the same condition, the same time period. And to think that it would be different would seem to be trying to put something into the text that's simply not there. These people had suffered immeasurably. Yes, these Christians had experienced the new birth, and some people think that's what the first resurrection is, and they certainly have experienced that. That doesn't seem to fit the context to me, but it might be what he's talking about. But to me, these people had seen the church almost destroyed through all the terrible persecutions, the killings, the torturings, the tormenting, the suffering, all these types of persecutions. And now with the Roman Empire dead, they see this great resurrection of the cause of Christ. And to me, that really fits the context of what I would be seeing if I was in the first century. Because I would be told by John that this attempt by the Roman Empire to kill the church wasn't going to be successful. Now, he's told them that in a number of different figures, different symbols in the past few chapters, that it wasn't going to be successful. And now toward the end of the book, he emphasizes that. Because Revelation chapter 20, it's about the end of the prophetic part. Because the last two chapters primarily talks about the great reward of heaven. So this last chapter that is talking about the final and ultimate defeat of Satan is going to be very consoling and comforting to the people in the first century. And that's how I want to look at this book, is through their eyes, if I can possibly do that. That would comfort me, knowing that the cause was the persecution was going to end, the suffering was going to stop. This their main enemy, represented by the beast, and again the harlot, was going to be brought down by God. That to me would be a great comfort. And so we see that. But now he says, verse 7, now when the 1,000 years have expired. Again, this has to be the same 1,000 years that he's talked about in each of these verses. Why would it be a different 1,000 years? Satan will be released from his prison. Remember, he's been in the bottomless pit, the abyss. He's been chained. His influence has been greatly reduced. But why was it reduced? Well, first of all, the Roman Empire had been destroyed. And that huge enemy that had such incredible power to try and enforce worship of false gods, false emperors, and so forth, that nation and empire had been destroyed. And so when we keep that in mind, this seems to make a lot more sense. At least it does to me. So when that 1,000 years have been expired, it says Satan is going to be released. He's been bound by God. But during that time period, the Roman Empire has not been there to bind the spreading of the gospel either. So it's had a great ability to spread. And it did in places, other places it didn't. But what's going to happen? It says he's going to go out to deceive the nations. Here's what Satan does. He goes out to deceive the nations. That's what he had been doing in the first century, in the second century, had been deceiving the nations. Through what? The Roman Empire. He had had the ability to use this wealthy, powerful empire to try and destroy Christianity. The nations are where? In the four corners of the earth. Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. If we go back to the Old Testament, Gog and Magog represented God's enemies then, and that's surely what he's talking about here. Not a literal Gog and Magog. He isn't going to resurrect those people and nations, but symbolically, they're enemies of God's people. So he gathers them to battle, and their number is numberless. They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. Seems to definitely be talking about the church. The church is often depicted as that beloved city. And so we see the church being attacked, if you will. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. If we have this vision of a small group of people, if we want to literalize it for a moment, we have this small group of people surrounded by this vast, enormous, powerful army, and the army's about ready to descend and destroy them. What happens? The battle's over. Just like that, it's done. Psst. Gone. God destroyed them. End of story. So many people in the world want to make that into some great scene, enormous battle, and yet we see the people arrayed in battle, but we actually see no battle. There's no battle mentioned in that verse at all, is there? You look at that, it's not there. They're arrayed in battle, they're ready for battle, and then just when they're getting ready to attack, what happens? Fire comes down from heaven and devours them. Not literal fire. Notice how there's practically nothing in this chapter that we should literalize. It's all symbolic and it's all figurative. So fire comes down from heaven and destroys them. And the devil who deceived them, remember the devil was behind all of this, was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are. Remember, they'd already been cast there. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Forever and ever. That's a long time. Satan, through the false prophet, the beast, the harlot, had tormented and tortured and killed so many of God's people that God is a just God. And so what does he do? He causes them to suffer forever. God's people had suffered for X number of years. But that was nothing compared to how much suffering Satan and his workers were going to suffer. Because they were going to be tormented day and night forever and ever. It was going to be endless. And again, if I'm reading this in the first century, and I'm in one of those cities and I've seen my friends and family killed because they refused to bow down to the emperor, I again understand that God's in control, and that even when it looks the darkest, surrounded by the enemies of God, surrounded by Satan, surrounded by the forces of evil, that they're not going to win. That's what these verses tell us. These verses are not about a thousand-year reign of anything. These verses are about the ultimate overthrow of Satan. That's what they're about. And to make it into something else is to try and make up some sort of man-made idea. It's about the final overthrow of man's final enemy. Those other enemies had been destroyed, cast into fire, lake of fire and brimstone. One enemy remained, that great red dragon, Satan, the deceiver, and he's destroyed. And so I read that and I know that Satan is not going to win, even if it looks bleak. So while it had a great deal of meaning to the people in the first century, it means a lot to us too. I mean, we can get a lot out of this. It does have some applications to us. There are forces of evil that are surrounding the church today, aren't there? Atheism and humanism and naturalism and denominationalism, and you just go on and on and on. All of those forces are evil, of evil are in essence surrounding the church, wanting to destroy the church. So when I read this, I get comfort in knowing what? They're not going to accomplish what they're setting out to do. It won't work. God is ultimately going to destroy them. And all the enemies of God's people from the beginning of time until now, this book says, are going to be thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone. Every one of those enemies, regardless of who they are or what they represented. So if I'm reading this in the first century, I'm reading this in the 21st century, I know those enemies of God's people are ultimately going to be thrown into that lake of fire. They're going to be tormented and tortured day and night forever and ever. That is a promise. That's a guarantee. So regardless of how bleak it looks, and at times it looks very bleak. At times it's just like the first century, and it looks like Satan is winning. Doesn't it look like that to you at times, that Satan is winning? Well, that's what he says here. He says it may look like Satan's winning. It may look like you're surrounded on every side. But don't forget that God is on your side, and God never loses. And he's not losing this one. And so whether it be the forces of atheism, the forces of this, the forces of that, they're not going to win. The church is going to win because God's behind the church. And that's the message we can take home from Revelation 20. Not about some thousand years or some reign with Christ. It's about our enemy being destroyed and tormented day and night forever and ever. That's what we really need to gain from these 10 verses. Not trying to come up with some sort of earthly, material, worldly type of understanding of 1,000 years and reigning with Christ. No. We need to come away with the main point, and that is our enemy is going to be destroyed. He's not going to win. And all we have to do is one thing, and that is remain faithful. See, that's my part. That's my part. I just have to remain faithful. That's what he told the people in the first century, wasn't it? Remain faithful. As long as you do that, Satan is not going to harm you eternally. Satan is just going to harm himself. And that message is still valid. Hasn't changed one bit. Our enemy is going to ultimately be destroyed. And don't let the things that happen in the world make you think that Satan's going to win. Satan doesn't have a ghost of a chance. We're already told who wins. The faithful. And there's our part. We're faithful. He's going to give us the crown of life. That's an absolute guarantee. We have to become a child of God first. By faith, be immersed and experience the new birth that we talked about. But second, we have to remain faithful. And that's often the hard part in the midst of all the evil influences and forces in the world, is to remain faithful. But that's what we must do. If you have a need tonight to respond, I encourage you to do it now as we stand and sing this song.